At daybreak, Madame Bovary Senior arrived. Charles, as he embraced her, burst into another flood of tears. She tried, as the chemist had done, to make some remarks to him on the expenses of the funeral. He became so angry that she was silent, and he even commissioned her to go to town at once and buy what was necessary. Charles remained alone the whole afternoon. They had taken Berthe to Madame Homais's. Félicité was in the room upstairs with Madame Lefrançois. In the evening he had some visitors. He rose, pressed their hands, unable to speak. Then they sat down near one another and formed a large semicircle in front of the fire. With lowered faces and swinging one leg crossed over the other knee, they uttered deep sighs at intervals. Each one was inordinately bored, and yet none would be the first to go. Homais, when he returned at 9 o'clock, for the last 2 days Homais seemed to have been constantly on the place, was laden with a stock of camphor, of benzene, and aromatic herbs. He also carried a large jar full of chlorine water to keep off all miasmata. Just then the servant, Madame Lefrançois, and Madame Bovary Senior, were busy about Emma, finishing dressing her, and they were drawing down the long, stiff veil that covered her to her satin shoes. Félicité was sobbing. "Oh, my poor mistress! My poor mistress!" "Look at her," said the landlady, sighing. "How pretty she still is. Now, couldn't you swear she was going to get up in a minute?" Then they bent over her to put on her wreath. They had to raise the head a little, and a rush of black liquid issued as if she were vomiting from her mouth. "Oh, goodness, the dress! Take care!" cried Madame Lefrançois. "Now just come and help," she said to the chemist. "Perhaps you're afraid." "I afraid?" replied he, shrugging his shoulders. "I dare say. I've seen all sorts of things at the hospital when I was studying pharmacy. We used to make punch in the dissecting room. Nothingness does not terrify a philosopher. And as I often say, I even intend to leave my body to the hospitals in order, even after my death, to serve science." The curé, on his arrival, inquired how Monsieur Bovary was, and on the reply of the druggist went on, "The blow, you see, is still too recent." Then Homais congratulated him on not being exposed, like other people, to the loss of a beloved companion, whence there followed a discussion on the celibacy of priests. "For," said the chemist, "it is unnatural that a man should do without women. There have been crimes." "But, good heaven," cried the ecclesiastic, "how do you expect an individual who is married to keep the secrets of the confessional, for example?" Homais fell foul of the confessional. Bournisien defended it. He enlarged on the acts of restitution that it brought about. He cited various anecdotes about thieves who had suddenly become honest. Military men, on approaching the tribunal of penitence, had felt the scales fall from their eyes. At Fribourg there was a minister. His companion was asleep. Then he felt somewhat stifled by the over-heavy atmosphere of the room. He opened the window. This awoke the chemist. "Come, take a pinch of snuff," he said to him. "Take it. It'll relieve you." A continual barking was heard in the distance. "Do you hear that dog howling?" said the chemist. "They smell the dead," replied the priest. "It's like bees. They leave their hives on the decease of any person." Homais made no remark upon these prejudices, for he had again dropped asleep. Monsieur Bournisien, stronger than he, went on moving his lips gently for some time. Then, insensibly, his chin sank down, he let fall his big black book, and began to snore. They sat opposite one another, with protruding stomachs, puffed-up faces, and frowning looks. After so much disagreement, uniting at last in the same human weakness, and they moved no more than the corpse by their side that seemed to be sleeping. Charles, coming in, did not wake them. It was the last time. He came to bid her farewell. The aromatic herbs were still smoking, and spirals of bluish vapour blended at the window-sash with the fog that was coming in. There were few stars, and the night was warm. The wax of the candles fell in great drops upon the sheets of the bed. Charles watched them burn, tiring his eyes against the glare of their yellow flame. The watering on the satin gown shimmered white as moonlight. Emma was lost beneath it, and it seemed to him that, spreading beyond her own self, she blended confusedly with everything around her, The silence, the night, the passing wind, the damp odours rising from the ground. Then suddenly he saw her in the garden at Tosters, on a bench against the thorn hedge, or else at Rouen in the streets, on the threshold of their house, in the yard at Bertaux. He again heard the laughter of the happy boys beneath the apple trees. The room was filled with the perfume of her hair, and her dress rustled in his arms with a noise like electricity. The dress was still the same. For a long while he thus recalled all his lost joys, her attitudes, her movements, the sound of her voice. Upon one fit of despair followed another, and even others, inexhaustible as the waves of an overflowing sea. A terrible curiosity seized him. Slowly, with the tips of his fingers, palpitating, he lifted her veil. But he uttered a cry of horror that awoke the other two. They dragged him down into the sitting-room. Then Félicité came up to say that he wanted some of her hair.
"Cut some off," replied the druggist.
And as she did not dare to, he himself stepped forward, scissors in hand. He trembled so that he pierced the skin of the temple in several places. At last, stiffening himself against emotion, Homais gave two or three great cuts at random that left white patches amongst that beautiful black hair. The chemist and the curé plunged anew into their occupations, not without sleeping from time to time, of which they accused each other reciprocally at each fresh awakening. Then Monsieur Bournisien sprinkled the room with holy water, and Homais threw a little chlorine water on the floor. Félicité had taken care to put on the chest of drawers, for each of them, a bottle of brandy, some cheese, and a large roll. And the druggist, who could not hold out any longer, about 4 in the morning, sighed, "My word, I should like to take some sustenance." The priest did not need any persuading. He went out to go and say mass, came back, and then they ate and hobnobbed, giggling a little without knowing why, stimulated by that vague gaiety that comes upon us after times of sadness. And at the last glass the priest said to the druggist as he clapped him on the shoulder, "We shall end by understanding one another." In the passage downstairs they met the undertaker's men who were coming in. Then Charles, for 2 hours, had to suffer the torture of hearing the hammer resound against the wood. Next day they lowered her into her oak coffin that was fitted into the other two, but as the bier was too large, they had to fill up the gaps with the wool of a mattress. At last, when the three lids had been placed down, nailed, soldered, it was placed outside in front of the door, the house was thrown open, and the people of Yonville began to flock round. Old Rouault arrived, and fainted on the place when he saw the black cloth.
Chapter 10. He had only received the chemist's letter 36 hours after the event, and from consideration for his feelings, Homais had so worded it that it was impossible to make out what it was all about. First, the old fellow had fallen as if struck by apoplexy. Next, he understood that she was not dead, but she might be. At last he had put on his blouse, taken his hat, fastened his spurs to his boots, and set out at full speed. And the whole of the way old Rouault, panting, was torn by anguish. Once even he was obliged to dismount. He was dizzy. He heard voices round about him. He felt himself going mad. Day broke. He saw three black hens asleep in a tree. He shuddered, horrified at this omen. Then he promised the Holy Virgin 3 chasubles for the church, and that he would go barefooted from the cemetery at Bertaux to the chapel of Vassonville. He entered Maromme, shouting for the people of the inn, burst open the door with a thrust of his shoulder, made for a sack of oats, emptied a bottle of sweet cider into the manger, and again mounted his nag, whose feet struck fire as it dashed along. He said to himself that no doubt they would save her. The doctors would discover some remedy, surely. He remembered all the miraculous cures he had been told about. Then she appeared to him dead. She was there before his eyes, lying on her back in the middle of the road. He reined up, and the hallucination disappeared. At Quincampoix, to give himself heart, he drank 3 cups of coffee, one after the other. He fancied they had made a mistake in the name in writing. He looked for the letter in his pocket, felt it there, but did not dare to open it. At last he began to think it was all a joke, someone's spite, the jest of some wag. And besides, if she were dead, one would have known it. But no, there was nothing extraordinary about the country. The sky was blue, the trees swayed, a flock of sheep passed. He saw the village. He was seen coming, bending forward upon his horse, belabouring it with great blows, the girths dripping with blood. When he had recovered consciousness, he fell weeping into Bovary's arms.
"My girl, Emma, my child, tell me."
The other replied, sobbing,
"I don't know, I don't know. It's a curse."
The druggist separated them. "These horrible details are useless. I will tell this gentleman all about it. Here are the people coming. Dignity, come now, philosophy." The poor fellow tried to show himself brave and repeated several times,
"Yes, courage." "Oh," cried the old man, "so I will have, by God. I'll go along o' her to the end."
The bell began tolling. All was ready. They had to start. And seated in a stall of the choir, side by side, they saw pass and repass in front of them continually the three chanting choristers. The serpent player was blowing with all his might. Monsieur Bournisien, in full vestments, was singing in a shrill voice. He bowed before the tabernacle, raising his hands, stretched out his arms. Lestiboudois went about the church with his whalebone stick. The bier stood near the lectern between four rows of candles. Charles felt inclined to get up and put them out. Yet he tried to stir himself to a feeling of devotion, to throw himself into the hope of a future life in which he should see her again. He imagined to himself she had gone on a long journey, far away for a long time. But when he thought of her lying there, and that all was over, that they would lay her in the earth, he was seized with a fierce, gloomy, despairful rage. At times he thought he felt nothing more, and he enjoyed this lull in his pain, whilst at the same time he reproached himself for being a wretch. The sharp noise of an iron ferruled stick was heard on the stones, striking them at irregular intervals. It came from the end of the church and stopped short at the lower aisles. A man in a coarse brown jacket knelt down, painfully. It was Hippolyte, the stable boy at the Lion d'Or. He had put on his new leg. One of the choristers went round the nave making a collection, and the coppers chinked one after the other on the silver plate. "Oh, make haste, I am in pain!" cried Bovary, angrily throwing him a five-franc piece. The churchman thanked him with a deep bow. They sang, they knelt, they stood up. It was endless. He remembered that once, in the early times, they had been to mass together, and they had sat down on the other side, on the right, by the wall. The bell began again. There was a great moving of chairs. The bearers slipped their three staves under the coffin, and everyone left the church. Then Justin appeared at the door of the shop. He suddenly went in again, pale, staggering. People were at the windows to see the procession pass. Charles, at the head, walked erect. He affected a brave air and saluted with a nod those who, coming out from the lanes or from their doors, stood amidst the crowd. The six men, three on either side, walked slowly, panting a little. The priests, the choristers, and the two choir boys recited the De Profundis, and their voices echoed over the fields, rising and falling with their undulations. Sometimes they disappeared in the windings of the path, but the great silver cross rose always between the trees. The women followed in black cloaks with turned-down hoods. Each of them carried in her hands a large lighted candle, and Charles felt himself growing weaker at this continual repetition of prayers and torches beneath this oppressive odour of wax and of cassocks. A fresh breeze was blowing, the rye and colza were sprouting, little dewdrops trembled at the roadsides and on the hawthorn hedges. All sorts of joyous sounds filled the air, the jolting of a cart rolling afar off in the ruts, the crowing of a cock repeated again and again, or the gambling of a foal running away under the apple trees. The pure sky was fretted with rosy clouds. A bluish haze rested upon the cottages covered with iris. Charles, as he passed, recognised each courtyard. He remembered mornings like this, when, after visiting some patient, he came out from one and returned to her. The black cloth, bestrewn with white beads, blew up from time to time, laying bare the coffin. The tired bearers walked more slowly, and it advanced with constant jerks, like a boat that pitches with every wave. They reached the cemetery. The men went right down to a place in the grass where a grave was dug. They ranged themselves all round, and while the priest spoke, the red soil thrown up at the sides kept noiselessly slipping down at the corners. Then, when the four ropes were arranged, the coffin was placed upon them. He watched it descend. It seemed descending forever. At last a thud was heard. The ropes creaked as they were drawn up. Then Bournisien took the spade handed to him by Lestiboudois. With his left hand all the time sprinkling water, with the right he vigorously threw in a large spadeful, and the wood of the coffin, struck by the pebbles, gave forth that dread sound that seems to us the reverberation of eternity. The ecclesiastic passed the holy water sprinkler to his neighbour. This was Homais. He swung it gravely, then handed it to Charles, who sank to his knees in the earth and threw in handfuls of it, crying, "Adieu!" He sent her kisses. He dragged himself towards the grave to engulf himself with her. They led him away, and he soon grew calmer, feeling, perhaps like the others, a vague satisfaction that it was all over. Old Rouault, on his way back, began quietly smoking a pipe, which Homais, in his innermost conscience, thought not quite the thing. He also noticed that Monsieur Binet had not been present, and that Tuvache had made off after Mass, and that Theodore, the notary's servant, wore a blue coat, as if one could not have got a black coat, since that is the custom, by Jove! And to share his observations with others, he went from group to group. They were deploring Emma's death, especially Lheureux, who had not failed to come to the funeral. Poor little woman, what a trouble for her husband! The druggist continued, "Do you know that but for me he would have committed some fatal attempt upon himself? Such a good woman! To think that I saw her only last Saturday in my shop!" "I haven't had leisure," said Homais, "to prepare a few words that I would have cast upon her tomb." Charles, on getting home, undressed, and old Rouault put on his blue blouse. It was a new one, and as he had often during the journey wiped his eyes on the sleeves, the dye had stained his face, and the traces of tears made lines in the layer of dust that covered it. Madame Bovary Senior was with them. All three were silent. At last the old fellow sighed. "Do you remember, my friend, that I went to Tosters once when you had just lost your first deceased? I consoled you at that time. I thought of something to say then, but now..." Then with a loud groan that shook his whole chest, "Oh, this is the end for me, do you see? I saw my wife go, then my son, and now today it's my daughter." He wanted to go back at once to Bertaux, saying that he could not sleep in this house. He even refused to see his granddaughter. "No, no, it would grieve me too much. Only you'll kiss her many times for me. Good-bye. You're a good fellow." "And then I shall never forget that," he said, slapping his thigh. "Never fear. You shall always have your turkey." But when he reached the top of the hill, he turned back, as he had turned once before on the road to St. Victor when he had parted from her. The windows of the village were all on fire beneath the slanting rays of the sun sinking behind the field. He put his hand over his eyes and saw in the horizon an enclosure of walls, where trees here and there formed black clusters between white stones. Then he went on his way at a gentle trot, for his nag had gone lame. Despite their fatigue, Charles and his mother stayed very long that evening talking together. They spoke of the days of the past and of the future. She would come to live at Yonville. She would keep house for him. They would never part again. She was ingenious and caressing, rejoicing in her heart at gaining once more an affection that had wandered from her for so many years. Midnight struck. The village, as usual, was silent, and Charles, awake, thought always of her. Rodolphe, who, to distract himself, had been rambling about the wood all day, was sleeping quietly in his chateau, and Léon, down yonder, also slept. There was another, who at that hour was not asleep. On the grave between the pine trees, a child was on his knees weeping, and his heart, rent by sobs, was beating in the shadow beneath the load of an immense regret, sweeter than the moon and fathomless as the night. The gate suddenly grated. It was Lestiboudois. He came to fetch his spade that he had forgotten. He recognised Justin climbing over the wall, and at last knew who was the culprit who stole his potatoes. Chapter 11. The next day Charles had the child brought back. She asked for her mamma. They told her she was away. that she would bring her back some playthings. Berta spoke of her again several times, then at last thought no more of her. The child's gaiety broke Bovary's heart, and he had to bear besides the intolerable consolations of the chemist. Money troubles soon began again, Monsieur Lheureux urging on anew his friend Vinçart, and Charles pledged himself for exorbitant sums, for he would never consent to let the smallest of the things that had belonged to her be sold. His mother was exasperated with him. He grew even more angry than she did. He had altogether changed. She left the house. Then everyone began taking advantage of him. Mademoiselle Lempereur presented a bill for 6 months' teaching, although Emma had never taken a lesson, despite the receipted bill she had shown Bovary. It was an arrangement between the two women. The man at the circulating library demanded 3 years' subscriptions. Mère Hourlet claimed the postage due for some 20 letters. And when Charles asked for an explanation, she had the delicacy to reply, "Oh, I don't know. It was for her business affairs." With every debt he paid, Charles thought he had come to the end of them, but others followed ceaselessly. He sent in accounts for professional attendance. He was shown the letters his wife had written. Then he had to apologize. Felicity now wore Madame Bovary's gowns. Not all, for he had kept some of them, and he went to look at them in her dressing-room, locking himself up there. She was about her height, and often Charles, seeing her from behind, was seized with an illusion and cried out, "Oh, stay, stay!" But at Whitsuntide she ran away from Yonville, carried off by Theodore, stealing all that was left of the wardrobe. It was about this time that the widow Dupuy had the honour to inform him of the marriage of Monsieur Léon Dupuy, her son, notary at Yvetot, to Mademoiselle Léocadie Leboeuf of Bondeville. Charles, among the other congratulations he sent him, wrote this sentence, "How glad my poor wife would have been!" One day, when wandering aimlessly about the house he had gone up to the attic, he felt a pellet of fine paper under his slipper. He opened it and read, "Courage, Emma, courage. I would not bring misery into your life." It was Rodolphe's letter, fallen to the ground between the boxes where it had remained, and that the wind from the dormer window had just blown towards the door. And Charles stood, motionless and staring, in the very same place where long ago Emma, in despair and paler even than he, had thought of dying. At last he discovered a small R at the bottom of the second page. What did this mean? He remembered Rodolphe's attentions, his sudden disappearance, his constrained air when they had met 2 or 3 times since then. But the respectful tone of the letter really deceived him. Perhaps they loved one another platonically, he said to himself. Besides, Charles was not of those who go to the bottom of things. He shrank from the proofs, and his vague jealousy was lost in the immensity of his woe. Everyone, he thought, must have adored her. All men assuredly must have coveted her. She seemed but the more beautiful to him for this. He was seized with a lasting, furious desire for her that inflamed his despair, and that was boundless because it was now unrealizable. To please her as if she were still living, he adopted her predilections, her ideas. He bought patent leather boots and took to wearing white cravats. He put cosmetics on his moustache and, like her, signed notes of hand. She corrupted him from beyond the grave. He was obliged to sell his silver piece by piece. Next he sold the drawing-room furniture. All the rooms were stripped, but the bedroom, her own room, remained as before. After his dinner, Charles went up there. He pushed the round table in front of the fire and drew up her armchair. He sat down opposite it. A candle burnt in one of the gilt candlesticks. Berthe, by his side, was painting prints. He suffered, poor man, at seeing her so badly dressed, with laceless boots and the armholes of her pinafore torn down to the hips, for the charwoman took no care of her. But she was so sweet, so pretty, and her little head bent forward so gracefully, letting the dear, fair hair fall over her rosy cheeks, that an infinite joy came upon him, a happiness mingled with bitterness like those ill-made wines that taste of resin. He mended her toys, made her puppets from cardboard or sewed-up half-torn dolls.
Then, if his eyes fell upon the workbox, a ribbon lying about, or even a pin left in a crack of the table, he began to dream, and looked so sad that she became as sad as he. No one now came to see them, for Justin had run away to Rouen, where he was a grocer's assistant, and the druggist's children saw less and less of the child, Monsieur Homais not caring, seeing the difference of their social position, to continue the intimacy. The blind man, whom he had not been able to cure with the pomade, had gone back to the hill of Bois Guillaume, where he told the travellers of the vain attempt of the druggist, to such an extent that Homais, when he went to town, hid himself behind the curtains of the Hirondelle to avoid meeting them. He detested him, and wishing, in the interest of his own reputation, to get rid of him at all costs, he directed against him a secret battery that betrayed the depth of his intellect and the baseness of his vanity. Thus, for 6 consecutive months, one could read in the Fanal de Rouen editorials such as these. All who bend their steps towards the fertile plains of Picardy have no doubt remarked by the Bois Guillaume Hill a wretch suffering from a horrible facial wound. He importunes, persecutes one, and levies a regular tax on all travellers. Are we still living in the monstrous times of the Middle Ages, when vagabonds were permitted to display in our public places leprosy and scrofulas they had brought back from the Crusades? Or, in spite of the laws against vagabondage, the approaches to our great towns continue to be infested by bands of beggars. Some are seen going about alone, and these are not perhaps the least dangerous. What are our aediles about? Then Homais invented anecdotes. Yesterday, by the Bois Guillaume Hill, a skittish horse, and then followed the story of an accident caused by the presence of the blind man. He managed so well that the fellow was locked up. But he was released. He began again, and Homais began again. It was a struggle. Homais won it, for his foe was condemned to lifelong confinement in an asylum. This success emboldened him. And henceforth there was no longer a dog run over, a barn burnt down, a woman beaten in the parish, of which he did not immediately inform the public, guided always by the love of progress and the hate of priests. He instituted comparisons between the elementary and clerical schools to the detriment of the latter, called to mind the massacre of St. Bartholomew, apropos of a grant of 100 francs to the church, and denounced abuses, aired new views. That was his phrase. Homais was digging and delving. He was becoming dangerous. However, he was stifling in the narrow limits of journalism, and soon a book, a work, was necessary to him. Then he composed General Statistics of the Canton of Yonville, followed by Climatological Remarks. The statistics drove him to philosophy. He busied himself with great questions, the social problem, moralization of the poorer classes, fish farming, rubber, railways, etc. He even began to blush at being a bourgeois. He affected the artistic style. He smoked. He bought 2 chic Pompadour statuettes to adorn his drawing room. He by no means gave up his shop. On the contrary, he kept well abreast of new discoveries. He followed the great movement of chocolates. He was the first to introduce cocoa and revalenta into the Seine inferieure. He was enthusiastic about the hydroelectric pulvermacher chains. He wore one himself. And when at night he took off his flannel vest, Madame Homais stood quite dazzled before the golden spiral beneath which he was hidden, and felt her ardour redouble for this man, more bandaged than a Scythian and splendid as one of the Magi. He had fine ideas about Emma's tomb. First he proposed a broken column with some drapery, next a pyramid, then a temple of Vesta, a sort of rotunda, or else a mass of ruins. And in all his plans, Homais always stuck to the weeping willow, which he looked upon as the indispensable symbol of sorrow. Charles and he made a journey to Rouen together to look at some tombs at a funeral furnishers, accompanied by an artist, one Vaufrillard, a friend of Bridoux's, who made puns all the time. At last, after having examined some 100 designs, having ordered an estimate and made another journey to Rouen, Charles decided in favour of a mausoleum, which on the 2 principal sides was to have a spirit bearing an extinguished torch. As to the inscription, Homais could think of nothing so fine as Star Viator, and he got no further. He racked his brain, he constantly repeated, Star Viator,
At last he hit upon Amabilem Conjugem Calcas, which was adopted. A strange thing was that Bovary, while continually thinking of Emma, was forgetting her. He grew desperate as he felt this image fading from his memory, in spite of all efforts to retain it. Yet every night he dreamt of her. It was always the same dream. He drew near her, but when he was about to clasp her, she fell into decay in his arms. For a week he was seen going to church in the evening. Monsieur Bournisien even paid him 2 or 3 visits, then gave him up. Moreover, the old fellow was growing intolerant. Fanatic, said Homais. He thundered against the spirit of the age, and never failed every other week in his sermon to recount the death agony of Voltaire, who died devouring his excrements, as everyone knows. In spite of the economy with which Bovary lived, he was far from being able to pay off his old debts. Lheureux refused to renew any more bills. A distraint became imminent. Then he appealed to his mother, who consented to let him take a mortgage on her property, but with a great many recriminations against Emma, and in return for her sacrifice she asked for a shawl that had escaped the depredations of Félicité. Charles refused to give it her. They quarrelled. She made the first overtures of reconciliation by offering to have the little girl, who could help her in the house, to live with her. Charles consented to this, but when the time for parting came, all his courage failed him. Then there was a final, complete rupture. As other attachments weakened, he clung more closely to the love of his child. She made him anxious, however, for she coughed sometimes and had red spots on her cheeks. Opposite his house, flourishing and merry, was the family of the chemist, with whom everything was prospering. Napoleon helped him in the laboratory, Athalie embroidered him a skullcap, Irma cut out rounds of paper to cover the preserves, and Franklin recited Pythagoras' table in a breath. He was the happiest of fathers, the most fortunate of men. Not so. A secret ambition devoured him. Homais hankered after the cross of the Legion of Honour. He had plenty of claims to it. First, having at the time of the cholera distinguished myself by a boundless devotion. Second, by having published at my expense various works of public utility, such as, and he recalled his pamphlet entitled Cider, Its Manufacture and Effects, besides observations on the lanigerous plant louse sent to the Academy, his volume of statistics, and down to his pharmaceutical thesis. Without counting that I am a member of several learned societies, he was member of a single one. In short, he cried, making a pirouette, if it were only for distinguishing myself at fires. Then Homais inclined towards the government. He secretly did the prefect great service during the elections. He sold himself, in a word, prostituted himself. He even addressed a petition to the sovereign in which he implored him to do him justice. He called him our good king and compared him to Henry IV. And every morning the druggist rushed for the paper to see if his nomination were in it. It was never there. At last, unable to bear it any longer, he had a grass plot in his garden designed to represent the star of the Cross of Honour, with 2 little strips of grass running from the top to imitate the ribbon. He walked round it with folded arms, meditating on the folly of the government and the ingratitude of men. From respect, or from a sort of sensuality that made him carry on his investigations slowly, Charles had not yet opened the secret drawer of a rosewood desk which Emma had generally used. One day, however, he sat down before it, turned the key, and pressed the spring. All Léon's letters were there. There could be no doubt this time. He devoured them to the very last, ransacked every corner, all the furniture, all the drawers, behind the walls, sobbing, crying aloud, distraught, mad. He found a box and broke it open with a kick. Rodolphe's portrait flew full in his face in the midst of the overturned love letters. People wondered at his despondency. He never went out, saw no one, refused even to visit his patients. Then they said he shut himself up to drink. Sometimes, however, some curious person climbed onto the garden hedge and saw with amazement this long-bearded, shabbily-clothed, wild man who wept aloud as he walked up and down. In the evening, in summer, he took his little girl with him and led her to the cemetery. They came back at nightfall, when the only light left in the place was that in Binet's window. The voluptuousness of his grief was, however, incomplete, for he had no one near him to share it, and he paid visits to Madame Lefrancois to be able to speak of her. But the landlady only listened with half an ear, having troubles like himself. For Lheureux had at last established the Favorite du Commerce, and Hivert, who enjoyed a great reputation for successfully doing errands, insisted on a rise of wages and was threatening to go over to the opposition shop.
One day, when he had gone to the market at Argueil to sell his horse, his last resource, he met Rodolphe.
They both turned pale when they caught sight of one another. Rodolphe, who had only sent his card, first stammered some apologies, then grew bolder, and even pushed his assurance, it was in the month of August and very hot, to the length of inviting him to have a bottle of beer at the public house. Leaning on the table opposite him, he chewed his cigar as he talked, and Charles was lost in reverie at this face that she had loved. He seemed to see again something of her in it. It was a marvel to him. He would have liked to have been this man. The other went on talking agriculture, cattle, pasturage, filling out with banal phrases all the gaps where an allusion might slip in. Charles was not listening to him. Rodolphe noticed it, and he followed the succession of memories that crossed his face. This gradually grew redder, the nostrils throbbed fast, the lips quivered. There was at last a moment when Charles, full of a sombre fury, fixed his eyes on Rodolphe, who, in something of fear, stopped talking. But soon the same look of weary lassitude came back to his face. "I don't blame you," he said. Rodolphe was dumb, and Charles, his head in his hands, went on in a broken voice and with the resigned accent of infinite sorrow. "No, I don't blame you now." He even added a fine phrase, and the only one he ever made. "It is the fault of fatality." Rodolphe, who had managed the fatality, thought the remark very offhand from a man in his position, comic even, and a little mean. The next day Charles went to sit down on the seat in the arbour. Rays of light were straying through the trellis. The vine leaves threw their shadows on the sand, the jasmines perfumed the air, the heavens were blue, Spanish flies buzzed round the lilies in bloom, and Charles was suffocating like a youth beneath the vague love influences that filled his aching heart. At 7 o'clock, little Berthe, who had not seen him all the afternoon, went to fetch him to dinner. His head was thrown back against the wall, his eyes closed, his mouth open, and in his hand was a long tress of black hair. "Come along, Papa," she said, and thinking he wanted to play, she pushed him gently. He fell to the ground. He was dead. 36 hours after, at the druggist's request, Monsieur Canivet came thither. He made a post-mortem and found nothing. When everything had been sold, 12 francs 75 centimes remained, that served to pay for Mademoiselle Bovary's journey to her grandmother. The good woman died the same year. Old Rouault was paralysed, and it was an aunt who took charge of her. She is poor, and sends her to a cotton factory to earn a living. Since Bovary's death, 3 doctors have followed one another at Yonville without any success, so severely did Homais attack them. He has an enormous practice. The authorities treat him with consideration, and public opinion protects him. He has just received the cross of the Legion of Honour. This concludes the reading of Madame Bovary.
This edition is distributed exclusively by Tantor Media, Incorporated. Please visit our website, www.tantor.com, for our growing library of inspiring, unabridged classics by renowned authors. We also welcome you to sample all our titles, listen to author biographies, and take advantage of special offers at www.tantor.com or call toll-free 877-7-TANTOR to request a catalog.